Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host today, and I'm here with Greta Anderson, who's co-hosting and also engineering for us this morning. We had our first snow here yesterday, but it's been snowing for several weeks up in North Dakota, where the pipeline resistance has continued at Standing Rock. There was a big announcement by the Army Corps of Engineers yesterday, and as we've been providing you with in-depth firsthand coverage of the water protection actions there, we'll be reporting on that unfolding event later in the show. But first, we're going to be talking about Cuba. As you likely know, Fidel Castro passed away last week, and yesterday, 10 days of mourning ended with his funeral. There's been a lot of coverage about what his death means to Cuba and beyond, and what his impact has been. As we do here at KHOI, we try to go behind and beneath the mainstream coverage and give you other perspectives on Cuba and Fidel Castro. So we're excited to have Dr. Lisa Corrigan joining us on the phone. Are you there, Dr. Corrigan?
I am, Gail. It's great to be with you this morning.
Okay. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Corrigan is an associate professor of communication at the University of Arkansas and also the director of the Gender Studies program there. To start with, maybe you can tell us how you came to be working in Cuba and learn so much about Cuba. You're a communication professor, so the connection with Cuba might not be that obvious to our listener.
Well, I'm primarily a historian of communication, so I'm interested in the relationship between the Black freedom struggle in the United States and the Cuban Revolution, and so I write about the ways in which the activists in the United States and the activists in Cuba cross-pollinated ideas between 1959 and the end of the 1970s. And so it was really through my work on Black freedom that I started writing about the connections between activists here and on the island. And so I've spent a lot of time in the Caribbean thinking and writing about social movements and revolutionary politics there.
Based on that, based on your experience, how do you think Castro's death will change or has changed life in Cuba, if at all?
It hasn't really changed Cuban life day to day yet, and it really won't until Raul abdicates in 2018. He has already announced that he's not going to seek another five-year presidential term. And, you know, in Cuba, there's no clear succession policy. They don't have a vice president. So It's unclear what the future will look like after Raul leaves. It also, I think, depends quite a bit on a Trump presidency and what his policy towards Cuba will be. A lot of the Miami Cubans voted for him. White Cubans in the U.S. overwhelmingly oppose Castro and the Castro regime as it continued under Raul. So I think that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty about what Cuba might look like, especially in terms of trade and what the U.S. trade policy will be, but also in terms of the ability of Cuban Americans to visit the island. So I really think that anybody who's talking about what it's going to look like is mostly speculating. There's not a lot of evidence about it just yet.
Because those policies will influence the day-to-day lives of people there.
They're going to be radically different than they were while Fidel was alive, while Raul was in power, and before Donald Trump was president. So it's an entirely new day in Cuba after Raul abdicates in 2018. I think that's when the big shift will happen.
And you mentioned the phrase white Cubans. Could you say a bit about that and explain, you know, kind of what those racial dynamics are in Cuba?
Well, they're complicated. I mean, most of the people who fled after the Cuban Revolution or were purged were light-skinned, Spanish-speaking descendants from Spanish colonization. So they were light-skinned, and they were bourgeois. So their property was confiscated during the revolution, and they fled to Cuba. A lot of the people who are left on the island after decades of, migration to the U.S. have been mixed. They're either mestiza, and so they are not light-skinned, or they're Afro-Cuban. And so one of the things that Castro did after he came to power was that he really made sure that Afro-Cubans had a place in government And although it's not as much as lighter-skinned Cubans, they have had a much more prominent, integrated place in Cuban politics and society. Now, that's not to say that racism is totally eradicated, but it looks and feels different in Cuba than it does in the United States, in ways that are tremendous. I mean, Cuba has, you know, fully subsidized health care. So, you know, black Cubans, Afro-Cubans aren't dying on the streets from their lack of access to preventative medicine, for example. And everyone has the same kind of educational experience. And Cuba has had a policy for decades to subsidize, you know, black citizens from other countries to get full free education in their colleges and universities. So there's been a real concerted effort after the revolution to try and create space for darker-skinned Cubans to have more political and social power on the island.
So that's a pretty significant way that Fidel Castro had an impact and perhaps should be remembered. What would you say are his other major achievements that we should note, either in Cuba or around the globe?
I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that the Cuban Revolution is the single most important radical political moment of the 20th century. I mean, it had tremendous impact on post-colonial movements around the globe, in Asia, in Africa, elsewhere in Latin America. Obviously, it influenced the black freedom struggle because so many black activists in the United States were sharing ideas and hosting Fidel in the United States or visiting him in Havana. I mean, the art of the Cuban Revolution has been tremendous in shaping public consciousness around the globe after Fidel came to power. But on the island, the medical advancements are really tremendous. I mean, it's the most literate country in the Western mm-hmm. Hemisphere. It crushes the United States in terms of adult literacy. And I think that Fidel will be remembered for maintaining a stable sovereign nation in the shadow of American empire. I mean, you have to remember that Fidel was not originally a socialist, but once the U.S. and the Organization of American States decided to embargo him after the failed Bay of Pigs coup in 1961, the embargo shaped Cuban life far more than Fidel's politics did. I mean, he could not control the fact that no one in the hemisphere would trade with him. And so the only countries that the Cuba could cozy up to were the Soviet Union and China, who were really willing to do trade with them. And that was a condition that the U.S. put on him, not one that was somehow organic or that he was drawn to. And so I think that historians of this moment will be very critical of American policies towards Cuba, mm-hmm. Especially the embargo.
So you're saying that really shaped the early years after the revolution and how he evolved and how Cuba evolved.
Oh, yeah. The U.S. basically tried to starve Fidel out.
Yeah.
I mean, after they tried to assassinate
him,
you know, dozens and dozens of times. And so, I mean, the U.S. culpability in creating and maintaining the power of Fidel Castro, for me, is the untold story that, you know, the mainstream news doesn't get because they're not reading in depth about the, you know, the history of Cuba. But, I mean, the U.S. made him what he was. We insulated him and his power in ways that would have never flown if we had traded with him, which is the great irony, of course, mm-hmm. of Cuba, is that if the U.S. had just traded with Cuba, there's no way that Castro would have stayed in power as long as he did. But, you know, there were many in the military circles and the foreign policy circles in Washington that wanted to keep him close and keep him demonized because it created a wonderful foil for American narratives about democracy. So there was a vested interest in keeping Fidel, you know, at an arm's length but entrenched in power.
Mm-hmm. And so what about the responses to Castro's death, both in the U.S., and how is that different than how other countries responded?
Oh, I mean, the rest of the world understands that Fidel was a complicated man, and, you know, Canada praised him, and I think Trudeau's conversation, mm-hmm. public conversation about Fidel's death really surprised a lot of Americans, mostly because they have just been fed little bits of propaganda about the Cuban Revolution, and there's no comprehensive, you know, space in American education to talk about the Caribbean generally or Cuba specifically. So I think it was a shock for Americans to think that the Canadians have a different relationship with Dell, but of course they do. They've been traveling there. Mm-hmm. They don't have an embargo. You know, they've been going to college there and doing, you know, educational exchanges and vacationing. And so they have a completely different sense of Cuba as an island, the Cuban people, you know, as a population, and Fidel as a leader. And so, you know, with them being the closest to the United States in some ways, culturally, I think that their response is a real shock. And you know, of course, many countries around the Third World sent condolences, and there was a tremendous outpouring of grief because Fidel had held on for so long, you know, and outlasted how many presidents? With like 10? You know, I mean, he was a legend in many ways. And so I think Americans wanted to see him as dangerous and evil because it's convenient for their narratives about themselves, even though it's not actually, you know, historically accurate to think of him as somehow this lone ranger that existed outside of U.S. influence.
Yeah, and even now you hear, you know, all these kind of comparisons between the Cuban situation in terms of political prisoners or just prisoners and human rights,
mm-hmm.
contrasting that with the U.S. Could you say a bit about how you see that?
I mean, Cuba has maybe not even 100 political prisoners, right? I mean, Amnesty International documents 97 of them. To compare, the U.S. has 1.5 million black men in prison, most of whom are there for nonviolent property crimes. So it's very hard for me to talk with, you know, barely literate Americans who don't really understand Cuban history or politics or what's happening there about human rights because the U.S. is the largest prison holder on planet Earth. I mean, we have the largest, most extensive network of prisons, both public prisons and private prisons. That's not, and I mean, it's very hard for me to hear that argument, especially because we have a torture camp in Cuba called Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
We regularly hold hundreds of people without due process. So there is no credibility in Cuba for the United States on human rights whatsoever. I think the strongest argument is about freedom of the press mm-hmm. in terms of places where there are contrasts. And of course, there is no freedom of the press in Cuba now. I anticipate that being one space that has a radical departure after Fidel's death and after Raul abdicates. I think that there will be more freedom of press probably in Cuba, and that you know, capitalism will push for that. But I'm not quite sure what that will mean in a Trump presidency, because it seems quite clear to me that the press is going to change under him in ways that will not be more free here. And that will undercut, in the United States, I think that will undercut our argument for how free things actually are. So I think that for your listeners, it's probably wise to have a much more expansive understanding of political rights and where they exist in the United States and where they're being eroded before they start sort of finger wagging in the Caribbean.
Are there other things that you think the average Americans, you know, should know about Cuba, but perhaps they don't?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the consequences of a closer relationship between the United States and Cuba, should it emerge, is the fact that tremendous amounts of tourism are going to destroy the entire ecosystem that exists in and around Cuba, and it will have a tremendous environmental impact. And I don't think that Americans think about the environment when they travel to the Caribbean generally.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they have any real sense about how economic development is bad for the countries that they live in. I mean, one of the reasons why the revolution was so popular in 1959 after it happened is because the Batista regime in Cuba basically held Havana as a playground for the wealthy Americans who came down and dig drugs and partied, and there was tremendous amounts of sex tourism. And as the border opens between the United States and Cuba, that sex tourism is going to increase, and it's going to be really devastating for the island. And so it's not just environmental impact, but there's a tremendous social cost for Cuba after having been held at an arm's length in the Western Hemisphere for so long, to have an influx of the American dollar, and it's not going to be a net positive, certainly in the short term, for urban Cubans at all. I mean, there's just going to be tremendous social exploitation there.
So they've kind of been spared the environmental destruction that has happened in other Caribbean islands because of the embargo and the relationship with the U.S. Yeah, so
yeah, I mean, Cuba is a very complicated place, but it's not Haiti. It's not Puerto Rico, you know. I mean, the fact that it was not within the U.S.'s shadow in the same economic way for the last 60 years made it a different kind of space, more stable, but more poor, but more educated. And I think that for Americans who want to participate in the conversation about Cuba's future, it behooves them to study the history of the countries in the Caribbean that have become very close to the United States in ways that have mixed results. I mean, Haiti is a complete and total, you know, humanitarian disaster. The U.S. did not invest in it before or after the tremendous, you know, hurricanes that have devastated it. It's corrupt with crony capitalism. The people are starving. And they have had a much closer relationship to the United States than Cuba has. But Cuba has emergency preparedness, and they are succeeding in ways that other Caribbean nations who are close to the United States are not. And I would behoove Americans to think a little bit more critically about the geopolitical history of the Caribbean before they start, you know, pointing at Cuba as somehow being inferior, because honestly, it's just really not.
Since you study social movements, this is a little off the topic of Cuba and Castro's death specifically, but because you study social movements, what are the connections you see between, say, the Black Lives Matter movement now and perhaps what you knew about the Black freedom struggles earlier, both in Cuba and in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, the thing about it is that Fidel Castro, if we're talking about political prisoners, took all of the political prisoners from the United States. So all of the Black Americans who had been active during the civil rights struggle, basically from Robert F. Williams on, Robert F. Williams was an NAACP field coordinator in North Carolina, and he was forced to flee the United States after a series of false accusations that were later recanted from a white man and woman who were part of this White Citizens Council in Monroe, North Carolina, who said that he was, you know, whipping up mob frenzy after white people had tried to kill most of the Black residents of Monroe County for integrating a swimming pool. And he fled to Cuba in the early 1960s and did a radio program called Radio Free Dixie, where he did a ton of, you know, radio work, just like you're doing right now, talking about the Black freedom struggle and civil rights movement in the United States. And from Robert F. Williams on, Fidel Castro, he allowed all of the members of the civil rights movement who needed to flee the United States because of political persecution to have non-extradition freedom in Cuba. And so there is a tremendous connection between civil rights activists and many of them who are still in Cuba because they can't come back to the United States because Black people don't have the same degree of freedom in the U.S. that white people do. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of ambivalence, I think, in Cuba about, you know, what it means to be American and how that relates to freedom, given how many political prisoners they've taken in. And a lot of those Black intellectuals who are still in Cuba, or the ones who went back and forth during the 60s and 70s, have influenced the ideas and the structure of Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And so there is, I think, a very rich and important connection between them, simply because, you know, the terrain of political and economic power in America for Black citizens looks startlingly similar now to what it was in the 60s. It hasn't changed all that much. So to me, there's even, I think, a moment for renewed interest in that relationship. And so I have a book out right now called Prison Power, How Prison Influenced the Movement for Black Liberation. And I talk at length about the relationship between prison politics in the U.S. and Black liberation and how Cuba has been a part of that conversation, how the war on terror has shaped that conversation, how extradition has shaped that conversation. And I think that, especially under a Trump administration, it bears more historical analysis to think about how Cuba and the United States and the tension between them has really shaped the contours of the Black liberation struggle here and abroad.
Well, that seems like a good spot for us to end our interview. So I was going to plug your book. You also have a blog. Do you want to just mention the name of your blog?
Yeah, I have a podcast called Lean Back. Lean
Back.
Critical Feminist Conversations, Lean Back. And you can download it on all of your preferred platforms, including, you know, Google Play and iTunes and those things. And I talk about race and gender and politics there with my collaborator, Laura Wiederhoff.
Okay. We'll put a link to that when we post this interview on our website. Thank you so much, Dr. Corrigan. You've really enlightened us this morning. It was a good way to start the day. And we're going to have a song now, and then we're going to turn our attention to Standing Rock.
Thanks so much, Gail.
Good.
Sincero, ¿de dónde crece la palma? Yo soy un hombre sincero, ¿de dónde crece la palma? Y antes de morir me quiero echar mis versos del alma. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Cardonio oruga cultivo, cultivo una rosa blanca.
Mamá, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera.
That was Guantanamera, a classic Cuban song that's based on poetry by Cuban poet and independence hero José Martí. The version we heard was one of those montages where many different people in different locations were singing and playing. It was called Guantanamera for 75 Cubans. Before we get to our next interview, I want to remind our listeners that the KHOI Fund Drive is going on now. Where else can you hear fascinating interviews like you are hearing with us this morning? Nowhere. And that's why you should support KHOI. You can make a donation or become a member on the phone, on our website, or by coming into the station at 410 Douglas. This is Local Talk on KHOI. I'm Gail Seiler, and Greta Anderson is here with me, engineering and co-hosting, and we are now bringing you special coverage on the surprise decision about the Dakota Access Pipeline that came out yesterday afternoon. Greta?
That's right, Gail. If you have not heard, the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and their allies won a major victory on Sunday in its battle to block the oil pipeline being built near its reservation. The Department of Army announced that it would not allow the pipeline to be drilled under a dammed section of the Missouri River, Lake Oahe. The Army Corps of Engineers said it would look for alternative routes for the Dakota Access Pipeline and require an environmental impact study, which was not previously done. This comes on top of a couple of events up at Standing Rock, a gathering of at least 2,000 veterans. We covered that on Friday. Bruce Espy, a veteran from Des Moines, was on his way to Standing Rock. And also an International Interfaith Day of Prayer on Sunday regarding the pipeline and its potential destruction. We're going to listen real quick to Chief Arvel Looking Horse. He is the I'm sorry, not the chief, not the chairman of the tribe, but rather the spiritual leader of the Lakota. He has the white buffalo calf woman pipe and serves as the spiritual spokesman. He spoke to the crowd yesterday at the camp. And here is Arvel Looking Horse.
Has been answered, and you know, this is so beautiful that you know, each and every one of you, I know that the Great Spirit is going to bless each and every one of you, and this is this is a winter count here right now, and you're part of it. Wopula Tonka for being part of this great gathering here, and people have said that no, this is either we make it or break it, and I guess we made it.
And you can hear the excitement about the decision by the Army Corps of Engineers to block the permit, the oil pipeline, from being built under Lake Oahe, the Missouri River. And on the phone, we have someone who was at that gathering. Mark Edwards, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. So, Mark, you traveled up with Bruce Espy, a veteran, on Friday. And did you think that this would be how your trip ended?
No, I was kind of looking at my arm this morning where I've written on my arm with a permanent magic marker, a telephone number to call for a lawyer. So we had been going through numerous civil disobedience trainings. So, no, it was quite a shock. It was quite a shock to lots of people. I think it's still a shock to lots of people. People, you know, have all these different things of trust issues with all this and what this will mean and time delays or whatever it means that now we're in a whole new world again.
Right.
We're focused.
Right. And you've been fighting the pipeline here in Iowa quite diligently, persistently. This has special meaning given the events of last week here in Iowa.
Yes, it does. I was at the Des Moines River when they finally finished that drilling there. And that was, you know, a sad day in lots of ways. And that's how I got up to Standing Rock. I knew I had this friend, Bruce, who's a veteran, and he felt very strongly that he should be up there. And so we decided to get in the car and go up there, and it was a lucky break for us to be in that experience. I think it'll be another lifetime experience I can never forget.
So describe the scene for us when this was announced at Ocheti Sakawa Camp.
Well, yeah, I think the official count was well into 11,000 people there yesterday. We had a nice weekend, sunny, warm. Things were going really well. And then you couldn't quite make out exactly what people were saying quite up front. But you could kind of hear a little bit that it was a big announcement. And as that happened, this wave of sound rolled down the topography. These are kind of a rolling hill valley, and it just, that's what I remember, is just the sound. It was like water rolling down the hill as that whooping and hollering and yelling just transformed the whole place. I mean, it was just changed your whole frame of mind.
And of course, the Lakota have been at this since April. They made a decision on April 1st to set up a camp over at Sacred Stone. Since then, numerous Iowans have been up to visit folks, first at Sacred Stone, and then when that camp sort of expanded beyond its boundaries, they had to go across the river to Ocheti Sakawin Camp. There was talk about the Army Corps evacuating, having to kick people out, or threatening to either do that or issue fines or block supplies to the camp. This is really a dramatic reversal.
Yeah, I think that was the shock. As I said, you know, we're in a militarized zone. It was shocking to me of all the military and helicopters constantly and that kinds of things. And so when that hit, it But like I say, it just broke the reality we were in, and from there on, you know, you couldn't make sense of it again. I mean, there was jubilation, but there was people crying. There was people going, oh, this, you can't trust it. I mean, there was every array of reaction to that. And I guess in reaction to this, I've been trying to analyze through the night. It was hard to even sleep and just thinking about all this. And, you know, I can't speak for the Native Americans. I can only give you my experience of being there. But I think that perspective and that way of looking at it, they might have had a different reaction in a way than me as a privileged white male. And I think that's what I hope really comes out of this, whether the pipeline goes or not. I think this perspective of the way we look at the world is transforming, and I think we all need that. So that's what I really felt out of it. This is, it doesn't matter what the outcome, whether the pipeline goes or not. I mean, it's getting easier and easier to tell what's right and wrong.
Yes, their leadership has been quite profound on this issue. Now, some of the repercussions for Dakota Access are this January 1st deadline does not seem reachable at this point for them. What do you know about that deadline?
Well, I'll tell you something else that came to mind yesterday, right before the announcement that was kind of helping me shift, is that there was supposedly a smoking gun has been found where the company actually knew way ahead of time about the grave sites and things like that, and they've been denying that all along. And yeah, the rumor is, and this, again, it's a rumor, but I think there's a lot of credibility to it, that they purposely did what they did, knowing exactly what they were doing, because they had the information of where these sites were long before the construction even started. So we're going to see how that plays out. And so that kind of gives you an idea of how we've been feeling about the whole procedure. I've been in this 3 years now, and I think the biggest part of all this is how it's going to play out now for me in Iowa, because it was, you know, the Des Moines River is my river. That's where I'm learning to be indigenous. That's where I, you know, my heart and soul is there. So I'm waiting to see how this wave of transformation up here now rolls down into Iowa, just like the terrain and the water. And I can't wait to see how that goes, because Iowa now has a chance to also feel this new way of looking at the world. Or I don't know if it's new. I think it's really old, but we seem to have lost our way and not respected that water.
This is Gail Seiler, also co-host here today. I just had a question.
Hi, Gail.
Thanks for being with us. Is your sense now that people will leave, that the camps will break up, or are people, for various reasons of being skeptical or whatever, not ready to leave yet? What's your sense on that?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because last night it took 2.5 hours to get out of the parking. but like I'm saying, you know, some people came for the weekend. It was really nice weather, so there was lots of people there that I think were just coming to see. They weren't quite sure what was going on there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the amount of 11,000 people, all the garbage feeding, everything. So all this is that there's lots of food, there's a lot of supplies. People were really waiting to get through the winter. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line for me is that when I talk to the Native American people that I've met, and they're sharing, they're saying their life is better at that camp than it is on the reservation where they live. They've got better food, they've got better protection, they've got a better community there than mm-hmm. where they came from, which is, you know, drug abuse, alcoholism, all these other things, and there's no alcohol in the camp, there's, you know, no drug. It's just, that's what really was the biggest thing to me, is that they love it there, as we all did. I mean, there's just this feeling. But they, even if it isn't, and they close down that camp, you know, it should be a historical monument from now on. I mean, there's never been an event like that in North American history where that many people came together, Native American tribes, and we're focused like that. So I think that there's the thing there. It could be a national monument, and then it could be managed different. There's going to be tremendous cleanup, things like that. So people are going to wait around to see mm-hmm. about that January 1st when we have a new president. People are somewhat skeptical, as they have, you know, should be after all these many years of
the history,
not trusting the government to do the right thing.
Well, thank you, Mark, for joining us this morning. And it's great to have a Central Iowa correspondent out there in North Dakota.
Well, thank you, Greta. It was wonderful being here, and I can't wait to take this back to Iowa and keep going there.
So, okay, we'll see you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Those who saw into the future predicted the destruction. If we didn't listen, the earth began crying out for us to stand up, defend the water, stand up.
I took a trip up the Standing Rock. I tell you, it was a big shock to find my people in distress. Oh my gosh, what a mess. Police and poor Ryan here. The natives have no fear. Unite the people far and near. The natives got to rise up. They are trying to provoke us with attack dogs and pepper spray. But this is a peaceful protest. Protect your stand your ground and pray. When the pipeline breaks, it would be the people's downfall. Tell you what, when the pipeline breaks, we'll be the ones who have to suffer. Yeah, water is life. Without it, you can't survive. I said, oh, water is life. No DA, be on pipeline. I said, oh, water is life. Without it, you can't survive. I said, oh, water is life. No DA, be on pipeline. Hey, Mr. Doppelman, can you tell me?
Welcome back to Local Talk. This is Gail Seiler. I'm your host today with Greta Anderson behind the control board and also helping out with co-hosting. That was a song that we don't really know who did that song or who made it, but it was written for Standing Rock, and it is about the idea that water is life.
Mini Wakoni.
It's the first Monday of the month. Is that right? Yeah. And that means that Keith Morgan is here for his monthly segment. Keith is the Emergency Management Coordinator for Story County. Thanks for coming in, Keith.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Yeah. And you brought another guest with you, Betty Bocella. Welcome, Betty.
Thank you very much. Well said.
She told me to say it with an Italian accent. Betty is the coordinator for the Coalition for Disaster Recovery, and we're going to hear about a new initiative that she's been working on. So we look forward to that. So, Keith, let's start with you, though. So we're going to be talking mainly about disasters and responding to disasters. What kinds of disasters are we talking about?
It can be the full range. We call it full spectrum. Anywhere from natural disasters, which are the most common around here, to human-caused disasters. Anywhere from a cyber attack to a hazmat situation, which is still human-caused along the way. In our line of work, we've gone away from looking at very specific kinds of disasters, and we look across the full spectrum, and we put together these recipes to be able to work with them. And one important part of our recipe is our volunteers.
So people are needed to respond to these disasters.
Probably the most important thing. I tell folks that I would rather have a well-trained individual that is flexible and adaptable to a situation than some piece of equipment that is only used for one particular kind of response and will be outdated in 2 to 3 years.
So people are more adaptable than equipment. That makes sense.
All the time,
and
yes.
Able to respond in different ways.
But they've got to be well-trained. There are some very basic stuff that we do for all the disasters to make sure that, for instance, how we interact in our chain of command, that is pretty much standard across all disasters. And that's why we need to get our volunteers in there early, train them up on some of the basic stuff, and then to get them into the very specific stuff so that they can be safe and effective if we do have a disaster.
So volunteers play a huge role because you just can't have, you can't hire the numbers of people that you need to be able to respond.
I am almost certain that the citizens of Story County wouldn't want to pay enough for us to have volunteer or essentially people trained and just sitting around ready to go if we have an event. That's where people within their communities taking care of their communities with a little bit of time and investment can make it so that we are very efficient. They're there ready to go at a moment's notice, and also it's cost effective.
And they're trained for specific kinds of things, but also broadly so they can respond to the unexpected kind of.
Exactly. The basics of disaster, how to be safe, how to know where to gather your information, and how direction can be passed from the top on down is the basic stuff. And then, for instance, some communities, we don't have one in this community, will have chainsaw teams. You might imagine that a chainsaw can be a little bit of a hazardous item to be wielding, and that's if we were to have one of those, we would definitely want them to be trained. We'd want them to have the proper equipment also.
With that particular skill. So how do you get and prepare all these volunteers?
Well, that's what we have the Coalition for Disaster Recovery, which I'm going to have Betty talk about. She is part of that overall structure where Betty is concentrating on how to both recruit, train, and do exercises with our volunteers, and also for us to have a structure so that we can activate them quickly. So I'll let Betty talk about the Coalition for Disaster Recovery.
Thanks, Keith. Yes, the Coalition has been around for a few years, but it seems that not enough people know about it. And so I just want to briefly describe what it is. The Coalition is an umbrella organization of nonprofit agencies, public agencies, faith-based groups, churches, service organizations that come together on a regular basis about four times a year and talk about what their role is or can be in a disaster. So that really helps a lot when the disaster happens to have that kind of information already known and figured out so that people aren't scrambling right at the time of disaster to figure out who's going to be doing what. So we have several active organizations in the coalition now with some predefined roles that they will fill. But we're always looking for more service clubs or churches or other nonprofit groups to become part of the coalition and to determine what can they bring to the table to help in the response and the recovery after the disaster. And so that's part of my job, is to help find those groups that want to become part of the coalition. And the coalition, I might say, is under the sponsorship of Keith's office, Story County Emergency Management, where we are together. We're not duplicative. We are not competitive, but we work together, and Keith oversees everything that I do. So if any of the listeners are interested in finding out more about the coalition itself, certainly they can contact me through Keith's office and find out how to become involved in those quarterly meetings. And Keith mentioned the exercises, and let's be clear what those exercises are. It's practicing what to do after a disaster. That's what an exercise is, if people don't know that. And annually we have an exercise where we practice what we've been talking about through the year and what we will do after a disaster. Find out where the weaknesses are, find out where the strengths are, and then know how to practice the next time around. So one thing that we're focusing on right now, is just a different way to get communities involved and to broaden our perspective out to the rural communities and try and get them more involved. And so we've come up with this idea of having community representatives from all of the towns in Story County and asking the mayors to appoint those individuals for 2-year term, so to speak. And those people would attend the coalition meetings. We would work at educating them and training them about disaster. And also we would expect from them that they would help us to spread the word in their own communities about what is disaster preparedness, what is recovery about. Hopefully they'll become very familiar with resources available to their community at the time of disaster. So our hope is to really strengthen what Keith's office is doing and can provide and what the local community can provide. So if I can just give an example, if we have a gentleman from Story City, for example, that's interested in being the community representative, so he will attend an initial orientation for the community representatives. Then he will attend the quarterly meetings, and then I'll be working with him back in Story City to identify those local churches, service groups, et cetera, that might become involved in the coalition and that would be willing to step up and be involved there in Story City in the event of a disaster. So if we can create this network of people across the whole county, it'll just strengthen the whole response and recovery process. So I'm pretty excited about this new concept. And so far we have three community representatives from Story City, Roland, and Cambridge. This is brand new. And again, if any of our listeners would know of anyone in the rural communities that might have an interest in this, someone who's very community-minded, wants to make their community stronger and safer place to be, those are the folks we're looking for. And they can certainly, again, contact me through Keith's office or go to their own mayor, more importantly, and say, I'd like to do this. I'd like to be a volunteer community representative.
So we'll put links for all of this on our website.
Great.
So the local organizations then can help with recruitment of the actual volunteers, and then you will train them, and they'll also be this like kind of – the community reps are kind of like a point person then?
That's exactly right.
Is that how it works?
Yes. We really need a local person to – for us to be able to contact. That's so critical to have that pre-identified so that when the disaster happens, there's just one phone call we can make, and then that person will.
I was wondering about that. Is there like a phone chain or something?
There might be.
Okay.
Yes, eventually.
Okay.
Exactly. Yep.
To let alert people that they're needed. And how much time do you anticipate if someone does become a volunteer, it would take for the training? And preparation.
Okay.
Like how big a commitment is it?
For the community representative or for any?
Maybe for both.
Okay. For the community representative, the orientation, I'm going to say 2 hours. And then those quarterly meetings are about an hour and a half. So that's four times a year. And then some of those other activities that I've talked about helping recruit local organizations and working with me to do that. Tough to say, because communities vary in size, but I would say, you know, maybe 4 to 6 hours a month max, and just to get this started is going to take a little more time from a volunteer, and I've worked with volunteers for years and very sensitive about the fact that they have many other things going on in their life. It's not just this project. So, I want to make this workable and probably whatever time they can give me up front to use that time most effectively. So if that community representative finds a local church in Story City again, for example, that wants to become involved, perhaps then that church would say, well, you know, we would be able to open up an emergency shelter here if we wanted to. You know, we've got this and this and this and this available, so maybe we could do that. And then we could bring in the necessary resources to help train those folks in that church to do that. And
so they could kind of decide with you what their focus would or what their part of the response would be.
That's right. Uh-huh. And Keith is very clear about the kinds of things that we need volunteers for. We're just not out there, you know, pulling anything out of the air. But if we know in Story City that we need a team of people to help with animals, with pets, you know, then that's something that we would look for. Folks
together
that have a particular interest in working with animals and can handle animals. So, again, looking for those, you know, basing people's skills on what the need is. Did I say that the right way around?
Yeah, and the sheltering is a great example because if we have something happen, we're going to need to get a shelter started right away. And these volunteers could get that shelter started and up and running. And then we have larger organizations such as the Red Cross that has a lot more skills to be able to run a shelter long term. Mm-hmm. They would be additive on top of these local volunteers. But having those people ready to go within that within that community or maybe the next community over mm-hmm. is absolutely essential for us to be able to meet the needs of those in that community right away.
So, yeah, that local element would make it much more responsive and quicker.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this is a new initiative. Is it modeled after something that's being done elsewhere, or did you all invent this?
I'm not going to say did we. This is something that Betty came up with, and it was a great idea, and it really reflects what we really stress around here. Disasters are going to start in the local community, and here in Iowa, we want to take care of ourselves, and I thought it was just a fantastic idea when she came up with it, and really multiply our capabilities by having people. Mm-hmm. Our office, we've only got two people that are full-time for emergency management, and we've got a lot of volunteers are but one segment of it, and by capitalizing on folks down in the communities, we can make ourselves much, much better.
Mm-hmm. If I could add to that, Gail, I've worked in nonprofit in human services for 40 years, just retired this summer here in Story County, and if I've learned anything, it's that the local community really needs to take ownership of projects, and it's much more effective than me coming in and saying, well, you need this and this and this and this. That just doesn't work as effectively. So this isn't really a new concept and that mm-hmm. it just makes more sense. And mm-hmm. just from experience, I know that if I can go to one person that I know in a community and say, here's what I'm thinking. What do you think? And then kind of let them take the reins from there and help. I'll just provide that extra support to get them where they need to be. So I'm hoping it's successful. I think it will be. I think it has great potential.
It sounds like a great idea, and that it would supplement the work that you all do already, Keith, in your office.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Like I say, and the folks that are in the communities will know what they need, and also they'll become an advocate across their community, especially when they're working with the mayor. Hopefully, they will be hand in glove with the mayor and the city councils on how to make their communities better. Because if we're prepared up front, we can usually save ourselves an awful lot of damage down the road.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a beautiful example of community involvement and community working within itself and together with the government and each other. That's great.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for being
thank
here.
You.
We've been speaking with Keith Morgan and Betty Bocella from the Story County Emergency Management. And that's it for Local Talk for today. And we'll see you back in about a month, Keith.
That's correct.
Great. Thanks for coming, both of you. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler, here with Greta Anderson. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Lisa Corrigan from the University of Arkansas, Mark Edwards, who was reporting live from Standing Rock, and Keith Morgan and Betty Bocella from Story County Emergency Management. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past shows online at our website, khoifm.org. You will also find contact information and links for the people and things we talked about. Local Talk was engineered by Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from people like you. We're in the midst of our fund drive. We'd like you to become a member or donate. If you're not sure, just think of all the wonderful interviews, perspectives, and information you heard on Local Talk today. You know you want more of that. So please support your community radio station. It's easy to donate on our website. Just look for the donate button at khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
K KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.
Support for KHOI comes from Stevens Auditorium, presenting the Nutcracker Ballet on Saturday, December 10th and Sunday, December 11th. More information can be found at center.iastate.edu.